Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to Make Money, an Ancient Guide to Wealth Management. Series Ancient Wisdom for Modern Readers. By Pliny. Translated by Luca Grillo. Read by Graham Mack. Introduction. The Sabines were devastating Roman land. They even approached the city walls and besieged a Roman army led by one of the two consuls. Since the other consul seemed unable to help, the Romans opted for granting supreme power to Lucius Quintus and sent messengers to appoint him dictator. They surprised Lucius while he was digging a ditch at his family farm, but he promptly answered the call and took command of the army. In only 16 days, he defeated the Sabines. Then, having fulfilled his task, he resigned as dictator and returned to work his farm. Or so the story goes. Of course, Lucius Quintus is better known as Cincinnatus. His legendary conduct inspired generations of Romans because it embodies some of their quintessential ideals. In him, selfless service to the state meets relentless attachment to one's farm. And the hardships of farming and fighting alike are successfully met. About 3 centuries after Cincinnatus, there lived another great farmer, Marcus Porcius Cato. Cicero tells us that, just as his ancestors did, Cato would serve the state as a magistrate or soldier, and then return to till his land. Someone once asked Cato about the best investment for one's estate. "Raising cattle successfully," he replied. "And what comes second?" "Raising them well enough." "And third?" "Raising them poorly." "And fourth?" "Cultivating land." "But," added the interlocutor, "what about money lending?" To which Cato replied, "And what about murdering someone?" When it came to livelihood, Romans had strong views, but perhaps they all agreed on one point. There is no greater occupation than farming. Indeed, the Roman economy, being typically pre-modern, was dominated by agriculture. And yet, when Cicero praised Cato for presenting agriculture as the most profitable, enjoyable, and dignified job, he was not thinking about the types of farming Cincinnatus did. It is one thing to supervise one's estates from a horse or a litter, and one another to get one's hands dirty and actually till the land. Whether or not Cincinnatus personally dug his ditches, his myth exemplifies an ideal that leading Romans continued to hold even when it became increasingly divorced from their actual life. Indeed, Romans idealized farming and service to the state as the best occupations and looked with suspicion or even contempt at other ventures, however lucrative. Yet these strong views were only part of the story. In real life, service was not always as selfless as Cincinnatus was. And over time, various professions, including money lending, flourished aside from raising cattle and farming, pace Cato. We can start making sense of how Romans earned a living then by appreciating a few tenets, which may feel more or less familiar to us. First off, the most respected and the most lucrative occupations did not necessarily coincide. For this reason, as we tour some of the numerous ways to make money in ancient Rome, we can examine how individuals creatively navigated the gap between profit and respectability. As one would expect, this gap led Romans to hold quite different views on the several professions. And we need to respect these differences, even when it amounts to allowing that contradictory attitudes coexisted. For example, Cicero distinguished between dignified and demeaning jobs. Agriculture is, of course, the most desirable occupation, while professions such as usury and tax collection lie at the bottom, because they elicit popular hatred. Similarly, any form of wage labour is servile, because the very wage is like a bond of slavery. Craftsmen engage in demeaning trades as well, and for the most part, merchants do the same. Occupations such as medicine, architecture, and teaching lay somewhere in between. On the one hand, they raise above the most demeaning jobs because they engage the mind and benefit the community. On the other hand, they do not fully suit the elite, being respectable for individuals whose social class they befit. In fact, more often than not, doctors and teachers in ancient Rome were slaves or freedmen. But Cicero ranks their profession above that of tax collectors and craftsmen, who were often born free. Cicero documents the view of the male elite, and this view documents a mismatch between economic profitability, moral respectability, and social class. It also documents a mismatch with different, and perhaps statistically more prominent, points of view. For example, contrary to the elitist perspective expressed by Cicero, plenty of inscriptions demonstrate that merchants and craftsmen took pride in what they did. They could sign their products, join in associations with colleagues involved in the same craft, sponsor events for the community, and publicly support local candidates. Graffiti from Pompeii suggests that individuals proudly identified themselves with their job, and that, by joining their craft association, they found a way to fulfill the Roman ideal of service and to contribute to the res publica, that is, to the state. For example, certain inscriptions read, "The chicken sellers invite you to vote for Epidius and Suetius. The mat makers ask you to elect Lollius. The grocery sellers ask you to support Marcus Priscus. And the bakers urge you to elect Trebius." And the list goes on. And yet the Roman elite typically looked down on such occupations. Some 150 years after Cicero, a poet named Martial even poked fun at some artisans' aspiration to partake in the civic life of towns such as Bologna and Modena. "Educated Bologna, a cobbler who repairs shoes offered some games for you. A wool fuller did the same for you, Modena. Now, where is the innkeeper going to offer the next games?" Another tenet of Roman ways of making a living, then, is that some very common jobs, being despised by the elite, are often underdocumented or completely overlooked by literary sources. To appreciate the work of female, middle, and lower class individuals, we must turn to graffiti, such as the ones found in Pompeii, and to inscriptions, especially epitaphs, carved on tombstones. Epitaphs vary dramatically. The wealthy, who could afford costly funerals and tombs, often recorded their life and achievements in some detail. More typically, however, epitaphs briefly commemorate the deceased by recording their name and, at times, by adding a few words about their family, age, occupation, and possibly more. For this reason, the following chapters place excerpts from literary sources alongside bits of information taken from Latin inscriptions. But we should not forget that a great number of Romans were buried anonymously in common graves, so that their lives and work lay beyond our reach. Indeed, it has been calculated that a cheap epitaph costs the equivalent of 3 months' wages for an unskilled labourer. Thus, epitaphs allow us to broaden our grasp of Roman ways to make a living beyond the narrow viewpoint of the male elite. Be that as it may, our point of view remains narrow. Roman society was sexist and hierarchical. For example, a very typical formula on epitaphs commemorating deceased females reads, "She kept an eye over the house. She spun wool." This common phrasing provides little information about the deceased, being basically a synonym for "she was a good woman," and hence expressing and reinforcing a social expectation. And yet, Roman society allowed for some surprising mobility as well, especially by the standards of the ancient Mediterranean. For example, epitaphs tell stories of successful slaves and women. Publius Decimus Eros Merula used to be a slave doctor from Assisi. He bought his freedom, spent even more in support of his local community, and left a considerable estate. Similarly, a funeral monument outside of Pompeii commemorates a freed woman called Nivolia. The monument includes an enclosure with various niches for burying Nivolia and members of her household. On top of the enclosure, an altar with sculptural reliefs represents a ship, among other figures, and an honorific chair. The ship must suggest that she made her fortune thanks to overseas commerce, and the chair commemorates an honor bestowed on her husband. Remarkably, her husband erected a tomb as well, to share with his wife. But Nivolia must have felt unsatisfied, and so she had another and more elaborate tomb built. The inscription both acknowledges and surpasses her husband. To be sure, there was no class and gender equality. But stories like Publius Decimus's and Nivolia's demonstrate that slaves and women could become financially successful and celebrate their achievements with pride. The elite rarely shared that pride. But Romans could question their own idealization of various occupations, including farming. A generation after Cicero, Horace ironically captured the widespread glorification of country life. "Lucky is the one who, removed from the cares of city business, ploughs the estate he inherited from his fathers. Lucky is the one who attends cattle, shears sheep, prunes trees, picks pears and grapes, and enjoys peaceful sleep at the murmur of running streams." This lavish praise of farming and idyllic portrayal of country life goes on for 66 lines, until the readers have a startling surprise. "Thus spoke Alpheus, the moneylender, who's just about to become a farmer. Then he cashed in all the money he lent out, and he lent it out again." Horace demonstrates that while being dominated by agriculture, the subject of Chapter 1, the Roman economy and psyche embraced other ways to make money as well. With Chapters 2 and 3, we abandon the countryside to meet the Romans in the marketplace, in towns and provinces, where some people made a living through taxation or through public contracts. This encounter throws up similarities to our world. They had companies with CEOs, employees, and shareholders. They crafted detailed contracts, regulated by meticulous laws, which took into account investment risks. They enjoyed a relatively open society, where talented individuals could start out from the bottom, even as slaves, buy themselves off, continue to invest successfully, and become billionaires. This openness was a source of pride for some, and a source of concern for some others. Whatever their attitude, Romans liked money and the power that comes with it. For example, Trimalchio bragged about his wealth. Seneca accumulated a huge fortune, but taught that wealth does not buy one's happiness. And Eumachia inherited a successful brick factory from her father. Having married well and outlived her husband, she used her money and influence to engage in philanthropy. In other words, some looked at their financial dealings as a measure of their worth, and some preached moderation in reaping interests, while some others, having made millions, took pleasure in giving back to the broader community. Giving back to the community was a means to express gratitude for the people's support and to secure yet more support for the future. Ambitious politicians would even incur debt in order to sponsor lavish gladiatorial games and other spectacles to entertain the masses. Chapters 4 and 5 show how such investments in popularity, which were unquestionably expensive, could win or lose one's fortune and reputation. Military campaigns could meet the same fate and bolster or ruin one's profit and respectability. Perhaps elites such as Cato and Cicero, and non-elites such as Merula and Nivellia, agreed that profit and respectability did not always go hand in hand. Chapter 6 shows that the gap between economic and social rewards is nowhere more evident than in human trafficking. Dealing slaves and managing prostitutes or gladiators was unquestionably legal, lucrative, and despised. For this reason, the elite often engaged in such activities through go-betweens, thus cashing in the money while saving face. Clearly, the Roman world presents many similarities to our own. But these similarities should not blind us to one more tenet of Roman ways to make money. For centuries, the Roman economy was primitive. The Romans had conquered an empire by the end of the 3rd century BCE, before developing a money economy and a political structure capable of sustaining it. Hence, to mention but one example, they forged a terrible system of taxation, as shown in Chapter 3. Eventually, they caught up with the realization that Rome was no longer a city-state, but the capital of an empire. But this bartering delay left its mark on the later mindset and vocabulary. To pay soldiers and workers, they used to weigh, pendo, a wage, stips, a process called stipendium. Workers could be compensated also with a munus, hence remuneration, which originally indicated a gift or payment in kind. The Roman mint was related to a temple dedicated to Juno Moneta, and around the time of Augustus and of Jesus, some poets started to use moneta as shorthand for money. The main Latin word for money, however, remained pecunia, which comes from pecus, cattle, and which brings us back full circle to Cato's ideal method of investing. For the Romans, money is cattle. English derivatives can be revealing and misleading at once. To us, pecuniary remuneration is elegant for money, please, while to the Romans it signified cattle, a common currency, but one you can't put in your pocket and take to the currency exchange. Unfortunately, we have no single ancient treatise about Roman ways to make money, and I suspect that if we did, it would take for granted much of what we may want to know. Fortunately, however, institutions, mindsets, and vocabulary, both sophisticated and backward, disseminated various hints. How to make money is a collection of texts which, like fossils, reveal traces of life crystallized from a different era. If we crack these fossils open, we can encounter this different era on its own terms, and in turn, this encounter may reveal many unexpected differences and similarities to our world. In accordance with the intent of the series, this book will present ancient wisdom to modern listeners by allowing a variety of classical texts to speak for themselves. However, it cannot even attempt to give a full picture of Roman occupations. For example, high mortality made will hunting widespread. Poverty and spotty control made theft and robbery quite common. And gambling was highly popular. These ways to make, or lose, money left a mark in official documents and in Latin literature, especially in comedies and in novels. But they lay outside the scope of this book. As you listen, you will encounter some ancient methods of making capital grow through no medium beyond the strong opinions of the Romans themselves. What were the risks and rewards of different jobs? And how did various occupations rank in the social and ethical imaginary of elite and non-elite Romans? Chapter 1. How to Become Rich, Envied, and Respected. Farming. Introduction. In the 3rd century BCE, two main powers coexisted in the Western Mediterranean: Rome and Carthage. Eventually they clashed. Thanks to the military genius of Hannibal, Carthage came very close to winning the war. In the end, however, Rome triumphed. Ancient and modern historians agree that the contenders had comparable resources and power, and yet they were radically different. Carthage had developed a maritime and commercial empire. It mostly cared about keeping control over some ports strategic for safeguarding its trade network in the Mediterranean. As a result, when it came to war, Carthage heavily relied on its fleet and employed mercenaries. The Roman economy, on the other hand, was neither commercial nor industrial, but agricultural. Accordingly, Rome relied mainly on its infantry, and the core of its army was made up of farmers, who fought to defend their land. In many ways, the outcome of the Second Punic War transformed the Roman economy, but it did not alter its nature. Rome remained grounded in agriculture. Indeed, upon defeating Carthage, Romans, not content with their new acquisition of strategic ports, actually created two new provinces, Sardinia and Sicily. In other words, farmers wanted more land. Indeed, in return for their service, soldiers could expect a stipend and special rewards, which mostly depended on their rank in the army and on the success and generosity of a general. The highest reward was a plot of land. This plot typically was part of some freshly conquered territory, though some plots were located in reclaimed land or in newly established colonies. Florence, Bologna, Cologne, meaning the colony. York and Lyon owe their origins, or their growth, to settlements of land-hungry veterans. It would be hard to overstate the central position that agriculture occupied in the Roman psyche. As mentioned in the introduction, pecunia is Latin for cattle, and hence for money. Similarly, laetus means well-manured or fertile, and hence joyful, while felix, which means fruitful, came to mean lucky. If money is cattle, then being happy and blessed means having a well-manured field that bears fruit. Being a good farmer, then, was about more than achieving financial success. One can begin to see why the Romans reinvested in land the profit they had acquired through war and commerce. Clearly, the centrality of agriculture in the Roman imagination, economy, and language can reveal a lot about the ways they earned a living, with implications that reach beyond agriculture. For one thing, it means that however idealized, the story of Cincinnatus, who went from being a farmer to being a dictator and then back to a farmer, captures an unquestionably historical truth. Not only did Rome and the majesty of its empire grow directly out of an initially marginal and irrelevant peasant society, but even after Rome had become the leading economy in the Mediterranean, farming and agriculture remained the ideal and the measure of individual success. The first two selections of this chapter portray the endurance of the agricultural ideal and its adaptation to an economy that grew over the centuries. The next two selections reveal some secrets for succeeding in agriculture, or in other words, they show how to become rich, joyful, and blessed. For all this bounty, however, we cannot forget that, as Rome expanded its borders, slaves laboured long hours in the field, while the elite reaped the benefit of their work. The last passage, a short fragment from an epitaph, gives a voice to those enslaved and often invisible labourers. Texts 1 and 2. Introduction. How to choose a farm. When the envoys from the Roman Senate reached Cincinnatus, they found him working his land, and Livy specifies that he owned 4 acres. This may well be another piece of historical information. At the time of Cincinnatus, 5th century BCE, the Roman territory was as big as Delaware and looked like a quilt of small family farms. Typically, farmers passed on to their descendants their land and their dream, to work a few acres, produce enough to support a family, and then pass it down to the next generation. Truly, the 5th century proved particularly challenging for the Romans, but it taught them to defend ferociously their plot of land. After rejecting the Etruscan kings, traditionally in 509 BCE, the budding Roman Republic was besieged by enemies on all sides. Its economy was in desperate shape, with disruptions in trade and several crop failures. Besides, a series of epidemics hit, while civil unrest further challenged the survival of Rome. Fighting against the odds for a couple of centuries, Rome established itself as the main power in central Italy. Then, after defeating Carthage, Romans safely controlled the western Mediterranean. In 218, when the Second Punic War broke out, Cato was about 16 years old, and by the time he died in 149 BCE, he had witnessed a radical growth in the Roman economy. In many ways, his life must have been easier than Cincinnatus's. Cato, however, faced a problem that Cincinnatus never had. Cato needed to assess the quality of more than land for sale. Perhaps other Romans of his time nourished similar aspirations. Because Cato begins his treatise on agriculture with advice on choosing good land. What's the point of teaching agriculture to an audience of farmers? The type of farm Cato had in mind was quite different from what Cincinnatus and generations of Romans used to own. Starting from the Second Punic War, overseas conquests brought in more land and slaves. Cato envisioned a unit of about 25 acres, and much of his treatise dealt with something unfamiliar to farmers of earlier generations, such as the management of labourers and slaves, and the supervision of their work. Cato dedicated On Agriculture to his son, but he had a larger audience in mind, an audience that now includes us. This treatise is the earliest piece of Latin prose we have. The grammar is archaic, the syntax and style repetitive and bare, the tone straightforward, top-down and preachy. All in all, although some recommendations may seem banal, Cato's precepts offer precious insights into a world that, though changing, remains centred on agriculture. 2.5 centuries later, another senator,
Sample complete. Ready to continue?